Morning, Your Honors. My name's Tom Overton. I'm here on behalf of the appellant. Along with me at council table is Rick Gleason, and also in the courtroom, co-counsel Paula Greisen and Laura Schwartz. We're here today because summary judgment that was entered was simply inappropriate, and we're asking the court to send this case back to the trial court to consider the facts surrounding the sale of the insurance coverage that was done in conjunction with a car rental. What I'd like to do is take a few seconds to highlight a few of the important facts. I'd like to talk a bit then about the Davis case analysis, which is mandated by the Supreme Court. And finally, I'd like to talk about the construction of the actual language of the rental agreement and the insuring language in this case in conjunction with the competing public policies. With respect to the facts, at the time this car rental was made, Raymond Jewell, who was a consumer here, went to the counter. He was given a pamphlet. If I'm not mistaken, it folded in seven-way pages, slipped into a sleeve. It was all fine print. He was told that he was being given full coverage. He was actively misled by the real estate agent, who told him he had full coverage. It was bumper coverage. He was covered up to $1 million. And she, later on, it turned out, didn't understand the product at all. But to construe the policy, I think it was second page, it had some exclusions, and then a couple pages over, it actually had the insuring language, and we'll come back to that. But the fact of the matter is, this was not a simple policy that you could look at. It was stuck in a sleeve. The realities of the rental transaction and what everybody testified to as part of the record is that nobody reads this. She'd never seen anybody read it. To really understand the policy, you had to have a separate summary of the insurance, which was not given to the consumer, and the policy itself was not even available on site. There was no training for the agent. So all these things make up the background of the rental transaction. And then if we turn to the Davis analysis, which is what the Supreme Court says should happen in a car rental case, you look at the realities of the transaction and the particularities of these facts, and you determine two things. What were the reasonable expectations of the consumer? And two, was this contract otherwise unconscionable, notwithstanding the reasonable expectations of the consumer? And that analysis just really wasn't done, and it should have been done.
Let me ask you this, Councilor.
Yes, sir.
Davis seems to me to focus on the latter. I don't really see it as a reasonable expectations case. It really seemed to go off on unconscionability. Isn't that a fair reading of it?
I think that's fair if you look at the pages that were devoted to it. But if you actually, in my view, if you read what was going on before that, it did talk about reasonable expectations of the consumer.
In a footnote?
At the full, look, pardon me?
In a footnote, was that?
No, I think when it talked about the Thomas case and the other cases, it was based upon from other jurisdictions. And then it said we adopt that analysis. And then it really did move on. And the bulk of the case did talk about unconscionability. I agree with you there. But reasonable expectations, I would submit to you, is certainly one of the two prongs of that case. And the other thing that's important about that case, it's not a property damage case or liability case like this one. It's a how do you analyze coverage in the car rental context case. So some of the distinctions that are made are really not really relevant, whether it's the loss damage waiver or, as in this case, liability insurance. It's really how do you analyze coverage, and that is the guidance we've been given. And I believe that, you know, the court below took the insuring language, set it next to the exclusion language, and said, well, this is clear, and I don't have to go any further to make my determination. And that's really just not what the Davis court says, that you do have to look at the totality of the circumstances. I would like to take a minute and move to the actual language before the court in this agreement, and it was set forth best really in Appellee's brief at page 2 and 3 under the statement of facts. And what it does, because this is a single policy from the consumer standpoint, there was a single place for him to initial that he wanted the supplemental insurance, and he paid a single premium for it. And what it says is, it talks, it's section H of the contract, renters third-party liability responsibility, and then the language is over on page three. It says where it's available and for an additional premium, and if you sign the contract in the right spot, we will provide you insurance. And then there's an A and a B, and it says, section A is, it doesn't use these words, but it says it's a statutorily mandated insurance, which is going to be provided by the rental car company. And then section B is, and it doesn't even say who the carrier is, then there's additional insurance up to $1 million. But from the consumer standpoint, and clearly what he was told by the agent at the desk, was he's buying $1 million coverage, and he doesn't really know, unless he frankly has a law degree, because you not only have to take the language here, find the corresponding language over here, you have to be familiar with the Myers case, which says with respect to statutorily mandated insurance, these exclusions are not, they're void, they're not enforceable. And so what we've got is a situation where the exclusions don't apply to the first 50,000, or in this 25,000 statutory and 50,000 for passenger. But they do apply to the remaining balance, and it just cuts it too fine, particularly with reasonable expectations, to get back to Judge Connolly's question. For a consumer in this circumstance to be able to figure that out, and I'd suggest to the court that most lawyers don't know that unless they just happen to be familiar with the Meyer case or have otherwise seen some experience, otherwise have some experience with insurance. So where does that leave us? That lends us to, there's supposed to be a factual analysis of the circumstances of the case, which wasn't done. It's not enough just to take the, quote, plain language of from this section, put them together and say that's enough. You have to look at the totality. Even if you do look at the plain language, what you have is a single policy language. It's got a couple of components to it, but it's a single policy. And we know under Colorado state law that the exclusions that are part of that can't apply to some of it. And I suggest to this court, because it can't apply to some of it, it's not the role of the parties or the courts to redraw and rewrite the policy language. Clearly, Lincoln General could have had two premiums, two places to check off, and said you buy in statutory minimum coverage, mandatory coverage, and then you get this other coverage. But that's not what they did. They lumped it all together, and by lumping it all together, I suggest to the court that the criminal acts exception doesn't apply.
When was the last time you rented a car?
I rent cars all the time, Your Honor.
When was the last time you read the full?
Never.
Pardon?
Never. Never read the contract.
So the expectation of the parties in these transactions is that the contracts will, in fact, not be read.
Well, that's partially true, Your Honor. That's the expectation of the car rental company, and that's clear in the record because this was summary judgment. Depositions are all we have per record. And Clay Hopkins, the manager out there, said nobody ever reads it. They discourage people from reading it. The Tanya Yunt was the agent, and she said she never saw anybody read it. And if you look at the case law,
companies, you don't even go to the counter. You just
right.
go out in the parking lot and grab your car and leave.
That's absolutely
the
right.
The contract is hanging from the mirror.
That's absolutely right.
Nobody reads those.
Well, but what the reasonable expectation, I agree with that. And what's the reasonable expectation in this case was the agent, I'm sorry, I'll try and stay close to the mic here. The agent told the person who rented the coverage or rented the car, he had full coverage, bumper to bumper, total coverage up to $1 million.
Comprehensive kind of coverage.
I'm sorry?
Bumper to bumper is comprehensive kinds of coverage.
He was told he had $1 million to cover the car, to cover everything. And the reasonable expectation.
He did have until he turned the car into a murder weapon.
Your Honor, it was my client who was murdered. Nobody's more sympathetic to that argument than me. But the fact of the matter is, I'm suggesting to you that the reasonable expectations were for him that, first of all, it should be sent back to the court to make that determination. And second of all, the reasonable expectation is that he did have coverage based on what he was told, and they knew he wouldn't read it, and they trained people to discourage him from reading it, and they didn't give him the summary that they had there at the counter for him to read. You know, they didn't offer that up. Secondly, I'm suggesting to you that because the way this policy was written was all lumped together, and the exclusion cannot apply under the Meyer case to some of it, it can't apply to any of it, and it's not the court's job, trial court or court of appeals job, to rewrite that contract.
And is that a separate argument? I'm trying to figure out, where does the reasonable expectations argument factor into the language of the exclusion?
It's a separate argument.
Okay.
It's, we should win under reasonable expectations, but we should also win, if you do send it back, you have the authority to send it back with directions in interpreting the contract, and I'm suggesting to you that should be that the criminal acts exclusion cannot apply because of this way this contract's
written. Second argument, is that a send it back argument, or is that something you just say, why should we send it back? We agree with that argument, we would just decide it now, wouldn't we?
Well, you would decide that the criminal acts doesn't apply and that there would be coverage, but then we still have these other ancillary claims that were dismissed because there was no coverage. For example, the insurance bad faith claim.
I understand that, but in terms of your second argument, that given Myers and given everything else, that writing it as a lump policy, you cannot exclude coverage since Myers mandates it for the $25,000. That would be something, I think, that there'd be no point to send that back. If that's right, then we would decide that now.
I think you're right, Your Honor. I think there'd be no point to send it back for a Davis analysis, but it would have to be sent back because of the other claims that were dismissed and sent back with directions. And I do want to take just a minute about policy. Time goes quickly up here, as I'm sure you know. There's clearly the policy on the one hand of this is a criminal act, and it shouldn't be that there should be coverage for that. But that's outweighed by four or five other policies of the state, and I want to tick through them real quickly. They're in the brief. The longstanding tradition to protect citizens on our highways. The clear policy that everybody should have insurance because the statute that says every car must be insured. The policy articulated in Davis essentially that says a consumer should receive the insurance they think they're receiving. There's a case that's Universal Indemnity versus Tenery case, which is cited, which says the liability policy purchased when renting a car is to benefit the public. And the need to protect consumers and this is a quote, unschooled in contracts of insurance, is a policy set forth in the Bernal case. And so I'm suggesting to you, we recognize our countervailing policies. We recognize that Raymond Jewell went out and did a horrible thing, and he's in Canyon City now because of that. And we recognize that there is a policy that you shouldn't insure criminal acts. But under this case, the way this was written, there's that exclusion is void because of the way it was written. And there are countervailing policies that, in our mind, outweigh the policies on the criminal acts. I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, my name is Malcolm Mead. I represent the defendant appellee, Lincoln General Insurance Company. It's important to understand what the plaintiffs are not arguing here. Plaintiffs do not argue that the restrictions in the rental agreement were ambiguous. In the trial court, they made that argument strenuously. They said over and over again, it's ambiguous. But when they saw our response in the trial court's ruling, they dropped that argument on appeal. Therefore, for the purposes of this appeal, they concede that the restrictions on use in the rental agreement are clear and unambiguous. Nor do the plaintiffs argue that the restrictions somehow do not apply to the facts of this case. Therefore, the plaintiffs necessarily concede that these clear and unambiguous restrictions in the rental agreement apply to the facts of this case. Nor do plaintiffs deny that Raymond Jewell used the rental car in the commission of a crime that could be charged as a felony. In fact, he used the rental car in the commission of many felonies and pled guilty to five of them, including second-degree murder, vehicular homicide, vehicular assault, first-degree assault, and possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute.
Ms. Mead, let me ask you this. Is it your position that regardless of what a rental agent tells a renter, that that cannot create coverage or create any question of fact in terms of reasonable expectations, given this policy? That it's basically irrelevant what Mr. Jewell was told?
I'm not sure if I would go that far, Your Honor. The facts of this case are that the rental agent told Jewell, you're covered bumper to bumper, or the car is covered bumper to bumper. If you get in a wreck, the car is covered, some variation of that. And I say, sure, she said that. He's covered. He's got $1 million of liability coverage. She didn't say, you're covered if you go out and use the car to murder somebody. She didn't say, you're covered if you go out and try to hit the police officers with your car. So the reasonable expectation, I'll go back to the reasonable expectations. No consumer, upon renting a car, has a reasonable expectation of using that car to commit murder. No consumer, upon buying insurance at the rental car contract, at the rental car agency, has an expectation of obtaining liability insurance for the civil liability arising from the use of the rental car to commit murder. That is not a reasonable expectation. Under the doctrine of reasonable expectations, you go back to what the average consumer would expect. The average consumer does not expect to obtain insurance to cover murder. That's simply off the charts.
What about DUI?
In the Davis case, it involved a DUI, and it sort of falls into the category of unintentional conduct. You intentionally have the drinks. You don't intend to use the car to commit murder after you have the drinks. So would a reasonable consumer expect coverage in a DUI situation? Arguably, yes.
How about DUI results in death?
Arguably, yes.
Okay. So
but still, we don't have an intentional act trying to kill somebody. Murder is an intentional act trying to kill somebody.
Well, I'm not sure that Mr. Jewell intended to kill somebody. I'm not sure that under criminally negligent homicide, you need to. What about criminally negligent homicide?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. He wasn't charged with that, but he was charged and pled guilty to second-degree murder.
Second-degree murder requires a knowing.
Yes. Second-degree murder and first-degree assault both involve a knowingly element. A person commits the crime of second-degree murder if he knowingly causes the death of a person. A person commits the crime of first-degree assault if he knowingly engages in conduct, which creates a grave risk of death to another. Both crimes involve the element of knowingly. A conviction for a crime involving a knowingly mental state establishes a conclusive presumption that the insured criminal intended to cause harm. That's from the case of Sventosky versus Dawson from this court. Jewell's conviction for second-degree murder and first-degree assault therefore establishes a conclusive presumption that Jewell intended to cause death and serious bodily injury. Further, Colorado recognizes that some criminal conduct carries such a substantial likelihood of injury that an intent to harm is inferred as a matter of law. Although this principle arose in cases involving sexual abuse of a minor, it's not limited to that context. Where the nature of the insured's conduct is such that harm is substantially certain to result, intent to harm is inferred as a matter of law. This principle applies whenever the criminal conduct of the insured is of such a dangerous character as to impose a substantial threat to the well-being and safety of innocent victims caught in the midst of that criminal conduct.
Well, that's basically depraved car murder, isn't it?
Could be, yes.
Let me ask you this. I carry automobile liability coverage on my car, and I realize you've not read my policy. But if I go out in the normal course of this kind of coverage in private policies, if I were to go out and drive exactly as Mr. Jewell did here and kill somebody and very seriously injure another, would my coverage, is there such exclusions as these in normal liability coverages?
Yes, Your Honor. Most insurance policies, auto insurance policies, have a criminal acts exclusion. Almost all have, an intentional injury or intentional damage exclusion. So if you use your car and you're in an accident, you accidentally go through a stop sign and kill somebody, of course you're covered. But if you see somebody on the street and you decide you want to hit them, no, you're not covered. That's murder, that's assault, that's an intentional act.
So if I drove as Mr. Jewell did here, I might not be covered for the resulting deaths.
If you intended to kill somebody, no, Your Honor, you would not be covered.
Well, but you just said if I drive under the influence 100 miles an hour in a 20-mile chase and collide head-on with somebody, I intended to kill somebody.
He was trying to hit police officers. He tried to strike two police cars. He tried to run down two police officers. Every car in his path when he was on the wrong side of the road at 100 miles per hour had to get out of his way or there would be a head-on collision.
I understand that. I understand all of that. My question is, would I be covered in the normal course of an underlying liability policy for driving just as he did?
Not if you have a criminal acts exclusion or intentional damage exclusion, no, you would not.
Are those common exclusions in general, normal automobile liability coverages?
Yes, they are. In fact, there's so many cases we cited in the trial court that I say it's obvious they're in policies. We got cases, you know, from every state in the union talking about these exclusions.
And there's, are there any statutory limitations on these kinds of defenses at all, Mr. Mead?
Good point, and perhaps back to your point also, Judge Roy. The criminal acts exclusion, intentional acts exclusion in your situation would not apply to the minimum coverage, the statutory minimum coverage. All the cases they cite when they talk about public policy involve the statutory minimum coverage. Yes, the law says you've got that no matter what. So if you went out and used your car, tried to play some game of chicken, see how many people you can hit, they would have the minimum coverage, but not anything beyond that.
Step down, what's known as a step down.
Step down provision, right. They were talking about how we mangled the two policies together, lumped them together. They concede over and over again in their answer brief and reply brief that he purchased two separate policies, a minimum policy and an excess policy.
Both provided by Lincoln?
No. The minimum policy was provided by Dollar. Lincoln is just the excess. He bought two separate policies.
Is there a problem with them being on the same contract?
No.
I mean, it seems strange to me that an insurance policy is sold in a rental agreement. And the rental agreement establishes the terms of the underlying insurance coverage. How is that done?
I agree it seems strange, Your Honor. It's done to facilitate the transaction. People want to rent a car and get out of there as fast as they can. They don't want to read a policy. They don't want to open up a dictionary, go through the terms. They want to rent a car. That's the objective. The rental agency says, okay, rent the car, and if you'd like to buy certain levels of insurance, you may do that. And he bought the higher level of insurance, which comes with two exclusions. Matter of fact, four exclusions would apply here. But I've lost the track of your question, so stop.
Well, I mean, it's sort of the question of who did he contract with? I mean, the agreement says SLI will, Lincoln, doesn't say, I don't think, who provides that coverage. It just says you can buy supplemental liability insurance. Where's the contract between Jewel and the insurance carrier here?
It's summarizing the rental agreement.
I understand that, but the insurance company is not a party to that rental agreement. Is this taken care of in contracts between Dollar and the insurance carrier that this is the way it's going to be done and the company will be bound? Is that the mechanism?
We don't have much in the record on that, Your Honor. I can speak outside the record. There's some sort of a complex contractual arrangement between Lincoln General and Dollar. Dollar sells the insurance. Lincoln steps in and says, we do the excess insurance. But the terms are summarized in the rental agreement. They say you've got to read a lot of documents to understand the scope of the coverage and all that sort of thing. They never say you have to read a lot of documents to understand the criminal acts exclusion. They never say you have to read a lot of documents to understand the intentional damage exclusion.
Let me ask you, what I'm struggling with, though, still, is the criminal acts exclusion seems to me would clearly exclude DUI, a DUI, wouldn't that? That would, on its face, would clearly exclude that. And you're saying is, I think, that you have to look to reasonable expectations or something else, that you're not going to apply that categorically to a criminal act of driving under the influence.
It's a misdemeanor.
DUI resulted in death. It's a felony.
The full exclusion says a criminal act which could be charged as a felony.
DUI resulted in death, criminally negligent homicide.
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I lost the track of your question. I'm sorry.
Okay. If a driver, Mr. Jewell, gets intoxicated and drives 75 miles an hour and kills somebody resulting in death and is charged as a felony criminally negligent homicide, all right? That would be covered, I think, would it not, by the criminal acts exclusion?
It would mark coverage, correct.
Okay. And would you concede that under Davis that would not, in fact, be validly excluded?
No, I wouldn't concede that.
Depending on what the agent told the renter?
Again, I mean, you could add infinite layers of facts beyond the record. Our agent said you're covered bumper to bumper. I just don't see that as meaning you're covered to commit murder, you're covered to commit DUI with death. And I had an answer and I lost it. Time out. Sort of what your question was getting at. Your question gets at a point which we delved in deeply in the trial court. Again, they dropped it on appeal. In the trial court, they said these exclusions, restrictions are ambiguous, because you might have a DUI at a death. You might close your eyes and go through a stop sign. You might make a left turn. Those are all illegal acts. But when you're analyzing a policy to see if it's ambiguous, you don't say, what if, what if, what if? You say, what did happen? You apply the language of the policy to what did happen, and you say, does this clearly apply or not? They concede on appeal it clearly applies. So all those what ifs, what ifs, what ifs fall by the wayside.
No, well, my hypothetical is meant to get at the fact that in some cases you would not simply end your analysis with the exclusion language, would you? In some cases you'd have to look beyond the language of the policy to something else, wouldn't you?
Perhaps, yes, perhaps.
So I guess my point is simply that the policy is not always the beginning and the ending point.
That could be, yes. If you did something less than murder, you might have to do more of an analysis. But again, reasonable expectations. Nobody expects to use a car to commit murder. Nobody expects to buy insurance to cover murder. And the Davis analysis is, you know, largely reasonable expectations. So even if we failed all the Davis factors, you go back to, well, what's the customer reasonably expect? You don't reasonably expect to rent a car to commit murder. You don't reasonably expect to get insurance to cover murder. So even
or,
if we
or if you do, if a customer does expect that, that would be unreasonable.
Correct.
Something
yeah.
We decide as a matter of law, as opposed to saying, what did this customer expect? What was he told? And what did he believe?
And reasonable expectations is an objective test. It's not subjective. It doesn't matter what Jewell thought he was getting, didn't think he was getting. It's an objective test. This court, I'm sure, can determine as a matter of law that the average consumer does not have a reasonable objective expectation of obtaining insurance to cover murder. We've got policies against it, public policies against that in the background. Again, there's lots of what ifs that they spun in the trial court, but we hit them with the cases that say you analyze the ambiguity by looking to the facts of this case and compare that to the language of the policy. The facts of this case are second degree murder and first degree assault. The language of the policy clearly bars coverage. There's no reasonable expectation of coverage under the reasonable expectations doctrine or under Davis.
Appellant's counsel says several times in the brief, if I recall, that we should look to the insurance carrier's policy, not to the rental agreement. Is there anything that he gains by going to the insurance policy itself? Are these exclusions in the insurance policy itself?
The same exclusions are in both the rental agreement and the insurance policy. The language is slightly different. So the trial court said, okay, let's just stay with the rental agreement. Well, here's the document the guy got. Here's the document Jewell got. Here's the language, it bars coverage. In the trial court, we did both analyses. We did rental agreement and policy. Both policies have the four exclusions that we analyze. The language on intentional injury, intentional damage is a little bit different. The criminal acts is a little bit different, but the substance is the same, but they parallel each other. That's why the rental agreement can summarize it. The rental agreement can say, look, here are exclusions that you're gonna encounter in the policy, but here they're summarized. Any further questions? Happy to address in my remaining 36 seconds.
You only have 36 seconds left and we had a green light yet?
I don't understand why the lighting system didn't turn that, but you obviously have been following it, so. We've got a lighting system failure here, counsel, but. Thank you for your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Overton, what?
Thank you. I'd like to.
That's what you have, so.
Minute 47.
Even though you have a colored light on, that's what you've got.
Okay, thank you. I would like to address some of the questions that were raised. And first of all, reasonableness is a fact issue. What was reasonable in this circumstance is a fact issue, and it can't be determined in a vacuum. And Judge Roy, that goes to your question about your policy. Your policy, you may have different reasonable expectations because it's a different kind of policy. You're not picking it up at the airport and you have, you know, every 6 months or a year, you have an opportunity to sit down at your leisure and look through it, and your expectations may be different. But the point is, the reasonable expectations under the circumstances, it's a matter of fact. The other thing is, you know, we talk about no ambiguity in the contract, but it should be this contract because this is what was given to him. He wasn't given the policy. He wasn't given the summary. This is all he had, and this is the insuring language by contract. But the fact of the matter is it unambiguously said criminal acts voids all coverage, and we know that's not true. They know it's not true. So you can't just look at this in a vacuum. And I also wanted to comment on the the DUI and the murder examples, you know, there was a question about knowingly. Well, knowingly applies to DUI just like it does to murder. And I think they conceded, well, because of the Davis case, the DUI might not apply, but it might not here. I think that the trial court should have an opportunity to look at the facts and see what Jewell's intentions were when he took meth. Did he intend to do this? In the few seconds I have left.
Policy doesn't require that he intended. Policy requires that he do something with the vehicle that could be charged as a felony.
Well, the policy says if you take this language from over here and look at it in a vacuum, I would agree with that. But I'm saying you can't do that. In the last couple of seconds, I'd like to address Rule 35F, I believe it is, and suggest that this case is taking the existing law of Davis and applying it in a new situation with liability. And also, it affects a wide variety of people. We have over 1 million people a month going through DIA, for example. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes our docket for the morning. The bailiff may announce a recess.